And it is about 25 minutes after the hour, and it's a Monday, Tuesday. It's Thursday. That'd be a therapeutic Thursday. Now theological Thursday, because Pastor Robbie Pruitt joins us. Robbie's an Anglican pastor. He's got an Oriental fan. It must be hot in Virginia. And Anglican pastors rarely afford air conditioning. So I'm glad to see him cooling off the natural way there. Pastor Robbie's the executive director of Preserving Bible Times and has become a great friend of the station. And for those of you who've been listening to us for a long time, you no doubt remember Doug Greenwald and his Wednesday visits with us. For about 7-8 years he did that. He passed away in 2019. Robbie has taken over for him at the helm of Preserving Bible Times, in addition to the board of directors there, and he's doing some wonders with it. I love what the newsletter has become, Robbie. I haven't seen one yet. Did you do one in July?
Yeah, I think we did like two or three in July, We're set to do another one. Alrighty. Here almost August. I got to get one out before I head to Poland.
Yeah, it's called Between the Line, but going to Poland, my goodness.
Going to Poland?
Yeah.
Heading to Poland. Good to be with you, Jim and David, on the Broken Road. A pleasure, as always.
Yeah. Was mentioning Between the Lines, that's the newsletter that comes out every month. Robbie puts it together and sends it out on MailChimp, so it'll come in your email. It doesn't cost a penny. And you'll look forward to every month, sometimes two or three times a month. And you can sign up at preservingbibletimes.org. And you got it. You look forward to that. Robbie, speaking of Doug, a lot of his work, probably the vast majority of his work, evolved or rose out of the book of Luke. And we used to talk about how his preference for Luke was partly because it's more chronological, and people could kind of follow a timeline. You have a broader approach than that, and today we're in Mark 6. Can you explain a little bit about your preferences? What's your favorite gospel?
That's a great question, and it depends on the day. There's four of them. And I like them all in their own right. I like to see them like I've got four kids, and there are four Gospels. And each of my kids are very unique. And I love them. I don't love any one of them more than the other necessarily. I love them for who they are, very uniquely them for different reasons. And they're my children. And I kind of feel the same way about the Gospels. I love each of them. And for different reasons, they have different personalities. They're written by different people at different times for different purposes. I've got a theory about why Doug loved Luke so much, and that's because he loved Kenneth Bailey.
That's true. Dr. Kenneth Bailey.
Yeah. So Doug was a huge Kenneth Bailey fan, and Kenneth Bailey, as well as Ben Witherington III, has written a lot about Luke's gospel. And Kenneth Bailey writes about the narratives, the parables, and the teaching. I mean, Matthew and Luke are rich and deep in Jesus's teachings and parables, and there's a lot of narrative there. Versus, say, John, which focuses particularly on the six I am statements and six particular miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 being one of them.
John is more passionate, more intimate. I guess based on his relationship with Jesus, and it's usually if I'm feeling crummy, that's the first place I go is the Book of John, you know. But there are wonders in Mark and in Matthew. Each of the gospel writers had a slightly different, well, sometimes vastly different audience. Luke wrote to Gentiles, and I was kind of asking you the question off air before we started here. Who was Mark's audience? Because I understand he was basically speaking Peter, wasn't he?
He was. So John Mark, not one of the original 12 disciples, but John Mark, who we see in Acts, and maybe we see him at the end of Mark's gospel, the young man that flees naked when the Roman soldiers come in the Garden of Gethsemane to seize Jesus. They lay hands on John Mark. Most likely that's John Mark. Mm-hmm. And he leaves behind his outer clothing and runs to flee, you know, strike the shepherd and the sheep will flee. We believe that because that's only in Mark's gospel, he's most likely writing himself in there. Mm-hmm. This is Peter's scribe, so he's writing on behalf of Peter. So when you're looking at Mark, you have Peter's gospel. And of course, Peter is God's instrument to minister to the Gentiles, to reach out to the Gentile people, where Paul is, Paul is to reach out to the Gentile people. Peter is to reach out to the Jewish people. But Peter's writing this particular gospel to the Gentiles and to a Roman audience.
Hmm. So it would have been logical, I suppose, for him to include more details from the Galilee region, which tended to be a Gentile region. I mean, there were certainly observant Jews up there, but many more Gentiles. It was a crossroads for commerce in Capernaum and around that lake. Tremendous commercial operations all around that lake. And one of the most intriguing episodes in Jesus' career happens, and I can't tell from this that it's Bethsaida, but that's pretty much where the feeding of the 5,000 occurred, is it not? Is that what scholars believe?
In the grassy hills north and west of Bethsaida. And
Mark just calls it a desolate place. That's all the clue we get, except that it's not on it, because they sail across the lake later to the western shore of, so presumably it was on the east. Is that what leads us to think it was Bethsaida? That was the home of Andrew and Peter and James and John, was it not?
Right. So this is part of why Peter's writing to this Roman Gentile audience, though he's God's instrument to the Jews, as mentioned. Sorry, I flipped those with Paul and Peter. Mm-hmm. I always think that Peter should have been God's instrument to the Jews, to the Gentiles, and Paul should have been God's instrument to the Jews, because Paul was a good Jew and Peter was eating with the Gentiles. So I always thought, well, why didn't we just flip the script? And that's always confusing to me.
That might be kind of a big assumption, because Peter, and correct me historically, also wound up at Ephesus for a time, and in Rome, where he met his demise, being crucified upside down. That's not exactly observant Jew territory, though there were observant Jews there.
Right, and Peter never really behaved well as a good Jew in terms of eating with the Gentiles, and Paul had words with him there. But you're right to point out, Peter's a fisherman. He's a blue-collar worker. He's right here on the crossroads of the east-west trade routes and the north-south trade routes here in the Galilee region, which is predominantly Gentile and influenced by the Roman, Greco-Roman world and culture. But in Mark chapter 6, we get insight that this desolated place, now, number one, there's a lot of grass there. Other gospel writers tell us that there's much grass in that place. So keep in mind that the feeding of the 5,000 is a miracle that happens in all of the gospels. John records it as one of the seven signs that Jesus is God. That's John's purpose. It shows up in Luke, it shows up in Matthew, and it shows up in Mark. And there's much grass in that place tells us that it's a grassy area. But then Mark's gospel tells us that when Jesus makes his disciples get into the boat, but to go before him to the other side, it says, comma, to Bethsaida.
Ah.
So the boat is crossing over the Sea of Galilee, most likely north of Magdala up in the hills where there's a lot of grass on the northwestern shore. And then they're kind of cutting the corner from one of the ports, most likely around maybe Magdala, over to Bethsaida. Now, we know the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee has changed drastically with the rising and the falling of the Sea of Galilee, which is how they found the Jesus boat from the first century, in the mud in the Sea of Galilee when the waters have dropped and the shoreline has receded. We also believe that Bethsaida had an inlet that was made it more of a port town that today it just doesn't exist that way.
Now, this is the northeastern part of the Sea of Galilee, if everybody has a mental image of Galilee or if you're looking at a map. But yeah, scholars found two locations, they think, was Bethsaida, and probably they were both right, but with water levels, because it was a fishing village.
Right, right. And this is the home of these disciples who were fishermen, Peter included. So Mark gives us Peter's gospel. And John Mark is recording this for Peter. It's for a Roman audience, 16 chapters, very action-packed for a Gentile audience. And there's nuance here, because after the feeding of the 5,000, it's followed by Jesus walking on the water. Now, we talked a little bit about the differences in the synthesis of the four Gospels. Each of them have something to offer. Luke's Gospel, which Doug, as we mentioned, Doug loved Luke's Gospel. And again, I think that's because Kenneth Bailey wrote so much about it that, you know, Doug was able to get those answers he wanted from an author he loved. And I, too, love Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes by Kenneth Bailey. But it doesn't have this account of Jesus walking on the water in Luke's Gospel. And it's only showing up in Matthew, Mark, and John that Jesus walks on water.
Is that because of writing to a different audience? I mean, this would have made quite an impact on the Galilee area. It probably would have been spread by word of mouth throughout Israel that this happened, that this was a miracle. And then, of course, later, the 4,000, which was on the southeastern shore of Galilee. So in a way, this is a pattern. That was an exclamation point put on the feeding of the 5,000 when he fed the 4,000 in the Decapolis. And a lot of folks will point to differences between the Gospels and say, oh, there's a conflict there. You can't have a contradiction. I mean, real life doesn't have contradictions. So what it does is it leads you into a deeper study of each of the Gospels and understanding that each is an individual viewpoint, a different author with different emphases for different reasons and a different audience.
Yeah, and why read one when you can read all four? And for instance, you know, this walking on water account is in the lectionary for me to preach on Sunday. And I've chosen this text from Mark, and I didn't think I would, because it's such a common story that everyone's familiar with Jesus walking on water. But why read it in one account when you can read it in all three accounts that it occurs? And had it occurred in all four, I would read it in all four. In the case of the feeding of the 5,000, it does happen in all four Gospels. So why not look at all of them, see what the similarities are, see what the differences are. For an example, we get into the motivation of Jesus in Mark chapter 6, which isn't included in John chapter 6. In John chapter 6, the walking on the water, you're talking verses 16 through 21. It's almost like a shortened account. Verses Mark 6, verses 45 all the way to 52. So we see an expanded account. In other words, Mark's spending more time on Jesus walking on water. He says more. And so because it's so unique, I actually felt myself gravitating towards, you know, preaching on this, because in the Anglican lectionary, we've got an Old Testament reading, we've got a psalm, we have a New Testament reading, and we have, of course, the gospel account. So I can choose from either of these or a synthesis of all of them. And I've, you know, really, it just caught my attention to go ahead and look at Mark's gospel. And this insight we get is subtle, but, you know, if you pay attention to it, it's also quite insightful. Let me give you an example of this. In Mark chapter 6, verse 46, Mark tells us, "And after he had taken leave," he being Jesus, after the feeding of the 5,000, "he went up on a mountain to pray." So we get that insight of Jesus's motivation. In John's gospel, it just simply says, "When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and crossed over across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them." So there's no emphasis, no highlight on Jesus's motivation, where Mark's gospel tells us that Jesus made them, told them to go. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat. And then Bethsaida is mentioned. Now, Capernaum and Bethsaida are two different destinations. And so there's a nuance here towards Capernaum versus a destination to Bethsaida. And here we see in Mark's gospel that Jesus, quote, takes leave of them, which means Jesus is trying to get some time alone. And that is in Mark's gospel alone, this emphasis. And we know why he wants this time alone. He's going to pray.
And that's so not unusual either. That was his practice.
But again, John doesn't record this. John doesn't mention this motivation at all. And then that continues throughout the account. In verse 47, it says, when evening came and the boat was out at sea, and he, Jesus, was alone on the land, verse 48, and he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. That's a detail that's not given in John's gospel. John does not record that Jesus sees them. John does not record that they're making headway, though painfully. In verse 18 of Mark's gospel, it says the sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And when they had rowed 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea. So this is quick. John's gospel account is quick versus John Mark, who is expanding on what's happening. What is Jesus seeing? How are the disciples doing? And another humorous, I think hilarious insight that Mark gives us. He number one, says it's about the fourth watch of the night, 3 to 6 a.m. He came to them walking on the sea. Now, that's what we know from John's gospel, but now verse 49 expands on this. Excuse me, verse 48. It says that he meant to pass by them. Only Mark's gospel says this, not John's gospel. He has no intent of stopping or getting in this boat or engaging his disciples at all. It's as if he just intends to pass by them and meet them on the other side. You get the impression, and I'm on the eve of a vacation here in the next 3 or 4 days. I'm about to take my leave, and I'm not going to take my work with me. I'm going to have some time of quiet, going to have some time of prayer, and I'm going to pull away. And I'm making that clear. I'm beginning to communicate that to people in preparation of me being gone. And this is the intent that you get from Jesus, that he's stepping away from his work. He's taking his leave. He's telling his disciples, hey, you go there. I'm going here. He's making that very explicit.
And don't text me.
That's right. Don't call. Don't call me. I'll call you. Mm-hmm. Don't text. Don't email. He's taking leave. And even when he seeks to meet them, he could have walked around the lake, but he's taking the shortcut. He's cutting the corner. He's going across the sea. But if you look at Mark's gospel account, he has no intent of stopping. It's only because they see him that he's now in a dilemma. And if you want to catch the parallel passage in Matthew's gospel, you can look over at Matthew chapter 14, and you can get Matthew's gospel account of the walking on water if you want to add even more detail to that. But Jesus doesn't intend to stop, and I love, too, that they're making headway painfully. Now, we live in a fallen world. And we live in a broken world. We live in a sinful world. We live in a world that has been affected by the curse of the fall, thorns, thistles, hardened ground. That, quote, wind that we keep seeing throughout the Bible. And I would make the argument that the east wind is a remez of evil blowing from the fall, when Adam and Eve are banished east of Eden. The east wind in the daytime withers crops. The east wind at the nighttime causes storms over the Sea of Galilee. You're talking about a lake that's 700 feet below sea level. So when the desert air cools and the easterly winds begin to blow, that cold air comes over the mountainsides of Gergesa, mixes with the warm air coming off of the heated water of the Sea of Galilee, and these storms arise in a moment, just an instant. So storms on the Sea of Galilee are normal. They're happening all the time. They're dangerous. And this is life. I mean, this is really a picture of life in the midst of a sinful environment. So
I'm interested too in that whenever the Bible gives us a time of day in one way or another, that always catches my attention. And we should explain the fourth watch of the night. And correct me if I'm wrong, but each watch was 3 hours. The day started at 6 p.m. So 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. would have been the first watch. And as you said, the fourth watch then is 3 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Right. So if there's an easterly wind, let's just think it through logically. If the mm-hmm. sun's been down that long.
I mean, there's a reason he gave us the time.
Right. Because if the sun's been down that long and the easterly wind blows, that air is that much cooler coming from the desert. And that storm's going to be that much worse. And so this Galilee picture of these disciples struggling at oar, which means, by the way, their sails are down. You can't keep your sails up in a storm like this. You've got to be in the boat at the oar paddling. And so they're making headway, and the text tells us painfully. Hmm. And isn't that life? In a hmm. sinful environment, we are all making headway painfully. Does it feel like that sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
Like you're against. Yeah, right? I mean, you're against the wind. Like the wind is against you. And that picture is clear in a fallen world. See, sometimes we believe that sin, you know, just affects a sinner. Like, okay, I did something wrong and now I'm suffering the consequences. But no, I'm in an environment with other people doing stuff wrong and suffering their consequences at time. When my consequences and their consequences intersect, I get a double dose of difficulty. But it's not just sinful people living in a sinful world amongst each other. When Adam sinned against God, creation fell. All of creation, which means the weather patterns. I don't know if you caught this on the news just this week, that one of the geysers exploded in Yellowstone Park.
No, I missed that one.
That it exploded mud and rock and just, you know, people were diving for cover. And this is a tourist destination where you're supposed to look at these geysers are beautiful, steam and water coming out of the ground at various intervals from the volcanic activity being so close to the Earth's surface that this steam and this water shooting up in the sky in the form of a geyser. And people come from all over the world to see this happen. Well, lo and behold, up comes the mud and the rocks, and it's raining mud and rock and threatening to kill people, and people are fleeing from every direction. Creation is groaning. Creation is fallen. Paul tells us this in his letter to the Romans, that creation is groaning, awaiting to be adopted. So what these disciples who were experienced fishermen and seamen, they understand what they're doing out there. They are stuck in the sea with the wind against them, making very little headway painfully. And that, no matter how experienced you are, no matter how good you are, if you're living in a fallen creation, it wars against you. And that's what the disciples are experiencing. And don't forget Jesus, because he's on a hike. He's on a hike on the water. And he, too, is experiencing making headway. But apparently, he's making better headway than they are. Consider it. They got a head start. He sees them struggling. Mm-hmm. He's making the same shortcut they're making, but he doesn't intend to stop. Oh, these guys are going to take forever. I'm just going to walk on by them quietly. They won't notice.
Mm. Well, it had to have been a dramatic scene, because I know on a big shallow dish of a lake, which is Galilee, when any wind blows, it kicks up serious wave action. And both Dave and I remember that from a lake called Mille Lacs Lake up there in Minnesota, which is a similar sized lake, as a matter of fact, shallow. And any time there are winds, I mean, the waves are awful. You cannot be on that lake in a storm. Mm. So we've seen that firsthand. And to understand how these sailors, experienced sailors and fishermen, they must have questioned Jesus a couple of times. You mean now? Wait a minute, there's a storm brewing. But they were obedient, and they did. And Jesus, when he went on his own to the mountaintop and prayed, what do you suppose he's asking for? Is he giving thanks? Is he asking guidance? Who knows? I mean, that's pure speculation. But somehow I think these times encouraged him and maybe gave him ideas as
well. Well, I mean, we've got to take in the context. Again, we're in Mark chapter 6. We're in John chapter 6. Jesus just feeds the 5,000. And John's gospel tells us in verse 15, right before we know that Jesus goes, we know it from Mark's gospel account, not John. We know that Jesus goes up to the mountain to pray. Mm-hmm. Again, we don't have that motivation here.
Just quiet time? Just quiet. I mean, it would have been an exhausting day for anybody.
Well, it's worse than that. John tells us in 6:15 that after the feeding of the 5,000, perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Doesn't say he's going there to pray. We get that insight from Mark's gospel. But for sure, this, by the way, is the opportunity for the fruition of Satan's temptation of Jesus in the wilderness to come true. Mm-hmm. If you just fall down and worship me, I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world. They want to make him king right now. This is one of the big three temptations. And so he's going back to pray and put himself in a position of humility and going to God on this.
Okay. Interesting, but interesting.
That's one of the things that's common. I've got a page up that talks about the translations, the number of different translations. And one of the constants is the make him king element.
Right.
That seems to be. So that apparently is a very strong combination of verbs and nouns in the original text.
Yeah, and Matthew's gospel doesn't have that piece about wanting to make Jesus king. Here, when they get Jesus in the boat after he calms the sea and the boat kind of teleports to the other side, in Matthew's gospel, the disciples say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." In Matthew's gospel account, they worshiped him. This is the moment they realize who he is. Funny as that may be, I mean, they just witnessed him feed 5,000. But it's this moment of Jesus walking on water and then calming the sea. And by the way, you think it would be in Mark's gospel, but it's only in Matthew's gospel that Jesus invites Peter to come out of the boat.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so this is the reason we need all three of these gospel accounts. We can't just read one, because each of them are adding something different and more, or leaving out something that's peculiar that they would leave it out. So by reading the gospels, to make it full circle here, to read the three gospels in stereo, in this case it's three, the feeding of the 4,000 is four gospels that has it, we get more insight, not less. So why read one account when you can read all three?
Excellent point.
Is there any clue to from the order in which they were written? I mean, the idea that they were written not necessarily at the same time, maybe staggered. Maybe somebody one started and the other one finished earlier.
You kind of wonder if they collaborated, if they talked to each other about their written work. That's a mystery that I ponder a lot. You know.
Yeah, the other one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was in I think it was Mark's gospel is that there was complaint during the feeding of the 5,000 that this was going to cost a lot of money.
Right. Well, and where would we get the bread? But that's a Philip thing, right? Because Philip's from Bethsaida. Mm-hmm. He knows. Oh,
okay.
From the region of that area,
More than half a year's wages.
Interesting. Each gospel has an important part in any serious study of Scripture, and so keep that in mind. You can have your favorite, but don't. You know, I've spent so little time in Mark. This has been a delight, Robbie. Thank you for getting me reacquainted with the book of Mark. Robbie, again, the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, their website, preservingbibletimes.org, and there you'll find lots of material, written and video and audio, that teaches what's between the lines in the Bible, helps you see things in 3D and four color, explains how the original audience would have accepted this information or rejected it, maybe. It's all part of it. Spend some time there, preservingbibletimes.org. Robbie, thanks for bringing us Mark 6 today, and we'll look forward to next week.
Well, I'll be taking leave next week in another time zone
that's
on
right.
The other side of the world.
Well, Paul has the internet, you know.
I have to figure out what time it is over there and see what we can do.
Travel safely. Be blessed. Bye-bye.
Godspeed, gentlemen.
Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks for having me on the Broken Road.